This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Welcome to this episode of Fairways and Greens. I'm your host, Gaylord Rhodes, the Vegas golf coach. And after 30 years as a golf professional, teacher, and coach, I decided it was time to share the knowledge and insights into the world of golf that I have gathered during my career as a golf professional. And joining me each episode will be a special guest from the golf industry. Together we will discuss and share their insights, expertise, knowledge, and stories from their career and life in golf as well. Hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, I welcome and appreciate your input and suggestions for future shows, as well as your questions. So feel free to reach out and get in touch with me, the Vegas Golf Coach, by emailing me at info@golfcoachpodcast.com. That's info@golfcoachpodcast.com. Reach out and let us know what's on your mind and what you're thinking about. So let's get started with today's show. I'd like to welcome in my guest for today's show, Mike Guillen. And I brought Mike in because I was at a golf repair store here in Las Vegas the other day, and I was getting some clubs bent for one of my students, and I noticed this book on the counter, and I picked it up. I was thumbing through it, and Mike wrote a book called Professional Golf for the Rest of Us, and it's basically a starter's guide to pursuing your dreams. And this would I found it rather fascinating because I also once aspired to play on the tours and didn't really have a college background in it and was just kind of I turned professional as a result and became a club pro when I realized I didn't have the talent. But it's a tremendous read for anyone out there who is thinking about, you know, taking their game to the next level. Mike started his career in 2006 and has been involved in the game in a variety of different ways. He started as a professional tournament money game player, and as we all kind of sort of did, and back in the day. He also worked as an outside service attendant, junior clinic instructor, and a junior summer league director. He had, unfortunately, as he was pursuing his dream to play out on the tour, he was in an event and blew out his knee, unfortunately, and it sidelined his career. So he, after a while, he decided to turn to writing. He's currently residing here in Las Vegas, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Great. So what's the purpose for the book? Why did you decide that you wanted to write this book?
Well, as I'm sure you know, when I started, as you mentioned, I started in 2006, and at that time there was social media wasn't really catching on. Like, even the internet really didn't have a lot of information. At the time, I remember having to call the PGA Tour headquarters in Ponte Vedra Beach and, you know, find out the information. And they actually had to snail mail me applications for Q School and the information for the sites. And so there wasn't a whole lot of easy access. And as you had mentioned, I'm sure it must have been difficult. I can't imagine having to, in the 1970s and 80s, having to find other places to play besides the PGA Tour. Other than just having to live near an area. So with all that said, this book was something that I would have wanted to read when I had first made the decision to turn pro. Considering the fact that I never really had a desire to go to college or play college golf, there wasn't a whole lot of information that was readily available as far as how to optimize the tournament schedule, how to really put the time in practice. And a lot of this stuff I'm able to talk about now in retrospect because I've lived it. I know how extremely difficult tournament golf is compared to playing social golf and then playing social golf for money and then playing strictly money game golf and then actually having to play in tournaments for a paycheck. Each one has its own pros and cons, and having the opportunity and a lot of time to really put some thought into it, that was the result of this book.
Well, you know, I can relate to a lot of it because back in the late 70s, early 80s, I thought, you know, and I had a full-time job and I had a family, and so I was, you know, toying around with the concept of making money playing golf. And of course, here in Vegas, there's money games all over the place. But I got out. There really, back in those days, there wasn't a feeder tour. The Hogan Tour, which started and it turned into the Nike Tour, which is now the web.com tour. The PGA now has kind of grabbed all the Canadian and the Mexican and the Pan American organizations and formed a united front to actually give people like you and I, me back in the day, an opportunity to play in the feeder systems. And there's, you know, they're very organized. They're a much, you know, at a little bit higher level. And I know when you were out there, you were playing in the mini tours like I was. And back in, there just wasn't a lot of money back when I was doing it. And I became very quickly realized that, you know, having gone to school at UT with Kite and Crenshaw, that it was, you know, and honestly, just to watch Ben hit golf balls on the range, we were the same age, and I was taking lessons from Harvey, and I watched him, and I thought, you know, I can hit the ball kind of that good. But the reality is, it's a whole different ball game when you get out there. There's a lot of good players, particularly nowadays, and probably when you were out there trying to aspire. There's hundreds of players that can play at that level. It's difficult. And so I found this book fascinating because it talks about the challenges you ran into. And, you know, I kind of like to refer to the chapter on, you know, the realities of what's going on out there. Can you share a little bit of that? I know you wrote a whole chapter on it.
Well, yeah. And the truth be told is that what the public sees whenever they watch golf on TV, and a lot of times what is missed is that there's you really only ever see the players who are playing their best for the 3-hour telecast. And what a lot of what gets missed is the fact that, you know, other than those top five, there's after the cut set, there's still 75 players out there who are competing and trying to work their way up the leaderboard. And even when you expand it beyond that, when you go into other tours, there are a lot of players that are really just as good. Like, you, unless you are an avid fan, you're never going to look at a first stage of qualifying school or second stage tournament results. But there are a ton of good players that get into first and second stage, and when they find themselves in one of those later stages, there's really not a whole lot as far as skill is concerned that separates them. What it really boils down to is which player has the clearest mind and which player has the breaks that go their way. You know, it's a ball that can, if you're playing at a golf course with really high rough, a ball that lands right in between can kick left into the rough, or it can stay in the fairway, and you're looking at one or two shots easy, saved or lost easily. And in a 54 or 72 hole structure, there's so many different factors that go into what produces the final result. And what a lot of people don't realize is that it's really just a matter of getting lucky and having the breaks go your way in those short intervals of tournament play.
No, I agree. I don't think people realize the fine line there is between winning and losing. Even, I mean, it's just an amazingly tough game mentally and physically, and it's gone to a new level. And I know we've talked about this before about the level of athletic ability out there that has developed over the last, you know, 10 years in particular. And it's amazing to watch these athletes, these top athletes, playing golf at a high level. And I just, you know, I'm looking at them, and they have mental coaches and teams surrounding them, and so, you know, you look at yourself as an individual trying to break into that circle, and it's not easy. It's not easy at all. And I like the book, and to the effect that I have some young students, some high school kids that are thinking about moving on, and I think it gives them a realistic look at what really is out there. And so they're not going to be surprised when they realize that there's a lot of other people out here that can play at my level. So let's talk about, you wrote another chapter in the book called Practicing, and I really enjoyed that chapter. I see, you know, being an instructor, I see this all the time. Why don't you go into that a little bit?
Well, and as you mentioned, even being an instructor, but if you hang around enough golf courses, and, you know, being that I've worked at two courses here in Vegas, and I believe six or seven probably throughout the Southwest, the one exception being a private club in Flagstaff where they don't have a driving range. But if you spend enough time, you'll see that there are players that really want to play professional golf, but for somehow either they were told or they assumed that a lot of it involved standing on the range and hitting balls for 6-7 hours a day, or hitting balls and then chipping and then putting. And that is, I can't tell you the number of times where I've seen players who do that and don't test themselves for money or for something of value on a regular basis. And then they're shocked that they, you know, shoot 85 or 90 in a qualifier or in a one-day event. I mean, because it's really important that if you're gonna play golf as a job, that it's practice is important, but it has to be very refined. There has to be an end goal involved. And in order to really get the most out of it, if you're really going to practice effectively, you really have to get out there and get on the golf course and put yourself in situations that you are most likely going to encounter during a tournament round. There's really no other way to go around it.
No question. My better students, I spend at this point in their development, I spend more time on the golf course than I do on the range with them. We look at their swing, we tighten up their faults. I'm just a set of eyeballs. I'm keeping them on track because, you know, here's the problem with Ranger Rick, and that's the guy that stands on the driving range and beat balls all day. You can groove compensations, you can groove bad technique if you pound enough golf balls. The problem is when you're on the golf course and you're waiting between shots and the mental part's going on, those compensations and technical errors in your swing are going to show up sooner or later on the golf course. And so, you know, just to have this, what you think, you know, I've got it, I'm hitting it great, I'm flushing it, I'm compressing it. And then you get on the golf course and everything changes because your technique. So basically as an instructor, I'm trying to keep them technically sound, but I'm teaching them how to play the game. I mean, I'm on the golf course and I'm telling them, okay, so I'm getting, you know, it's all course management. It's all understanding where to miss the shot if you're going to miss it, and whether you have the confidence to pull the shot off or not and to do something else. So I just, I don't know basically how you would learn the game if you didn't get out and play. So I spend most of my time, and I agree with you 100%. The range is it's not like practice isn't important, but it has to be very focused practice. And at a certain point, you have to leave the range and go out and learn on the golf course. So yeah.
And then to further illustrate the point, you know, even for a good player, for all good players who don't have any compensations, who are able to, you know, consistently strike the ball well. I know of plenty of players that can hit a shot flush from a flat preferred lie to know they, you may have a target on the range, but that target doesn't mean anything in regards to trying to post a score. It is a completely different, and I write about, and I talk about this in the in that chapter, where it's a completely different story when you have, you know, 167 yards with the ball above your feet to a pin tucked on the right, when your opponent's sitting there 10 feet away and you're all square in a $20 Nassau. I mean, just it's adding those elements, it's adding those layers of importance to being able to hit a shot. And if you don't put yourself in those situations, or if you don't even know the adjustments to make in those situations, it makes it all the more difficult to be successful as a tournament player, or even just a money game player.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, we get in situations on the golf course with my students, and we practice those situations. Uphill lies, downhill lies, sidehill lies, buried lies, under the lip. I mean, you just have to be confident in your enough to know that, hey, it's one shot at a time, and one shot doesn't make or break me. I just need to play the best I can. And you don't get that on the range. And I think that, you know, having experienced it myself, you know, where I'll go and I'll work on something specifically, but I don't have my coach's eyes on me, you know, and I have one or two people that are my go-to people. And when I start to struggle, I can look, you know, being an instructor, I have video, I have the equipment, I can look at what's going on. But in many cases, when I get on the golf course, what I'm doing inside is not the same that I'm doing on the course. And that's where I like to have that set of eyes saying, okay, you know, you've got the club a little inside, you're stuck, you know, and so it's the little things that you can learn on the golf course that set us apart. You know, I was a high school coach and I know Ann at Stanford. She used to be at UC Davis, and I know all the UC Davis team. I know Ray, and I've talked to a lot of the college coaches, and you know, they're not looking for the guy with the perfect swing anymore. They're looking for the players. They're looking for the kids that can get the ball in the hole, and those are the kids that will thrive in tournament golf. They'll thrive in match play golf. Their whole thing is, you know, they're not playing to lose, they're playing to win, and they fear losing, and so they want to win, and it's a special mentality, and you have to have that. You really do. It's like I remember Arnold telling us, Fowler talking to Arnold after he blew the tournament a few years back. And he said, you know, Arnold, I didn't hit the shot I wanted on 16, but I was trying to win the tournament, and I went for it. And Arnold said, that's what you have to do, son. You just keep going for it, because that's how you win tournaments. And I think that was profound.
Yeah, and no one failed more spectacularly, but also more more graciously than Arnold Palmer and Phil Mickelson are probably the two models that you would go for as guys that just they play to win, and it may not always. And you know, Phil has his own history on 16 at Bay Hill. I can't remember what year it was, but it's not a matter of second or third place to them, or even really about money. And that's, you know, that's obviously getting, you know, a little, you know, really high up into where all you're worried about is when you don't have to worry about making money. But it's a matter of mentality, and the only way you get that mentality is by continually challenging yourself or being pushed by somebody. It's one thing I talk about in the book, the importance of having a mentor, someone that actually played the game at a very high competitive level is probably more so important than having someone who can perfect your swing mechanics, because swing mechanics are nice, but it's not something you can really think about when you're in the heat of battle. I can't imagine, you know, a basketball player or a football player worrying about how their stroke feels while they have the ball in their hands and they got a defender on them. It's just a matter of execution and go with it. So,
yeah, I agree. There's a famous quote from Phil, and I'm glad you brought him up, but I mean, his attitude is this. I mean, you just fight. I don't care how it looks. I don't care how pretty it is. I just want to get the ball in the hole, and that's all I care about. And that's the kind of mentality you have to have out on the tour, because it's everybody's out there. They can all hit it as well as you. A lot of cases, it's the guy who gets it up and down and gets that lucky break and makes that putt at a key time. And honestly, if I was going to take a student and teach him anything of importance, it would be from 100 yards in, and putting especially at this point. And another thing, Mike, is I don't think a lot of these aspiring players realize how different the golf courses are that the tournaments are played on. You know, you can go, I know a lot of club pros that can go out and shoot 64 at their home course, and you put them on a tour course with the rough up, with a little distance out there and tucked pins, and they have a hard time breaking 80. And, you know, that's just because they're not used to it. I mean, And I think that's why today, having all the tours kind of unified now and having the college programs that we do, it's why we're seeing such a difference in the athletic ability and the talent of these young kids coming up. And we didn't have those opportunities.
No, not well. I mean, they were there, but they were also, I mean, the way it's changed now is that, like, for example, my very first tournament as a professional was the Arizona Open qualifier back in 2006. And this was at a time, up until probably 3 years after that, you had to be able to qualify to be able to get, just to be able to get into the tournament. Now, you know, with the way that the structure is now it's a matter of if someone's willing to put the entry fee up, are able to get entry. But I mean, to speak on that, that's why another trouble is, and that's why one thing I advocate in the tournament strategy is that you want to not only test yourself often, but if you're given the opportunity, play some different courses. If the opportunity allows it, rather than, you know, spending $15,000-$20,000 on one tournament series that's only going to take place in one geographical area, you know, save $5,000 and take a road trip out to courses. And I'm sure you know this coming from Texas, golf, you know, desert golf that we have out here in Vegas and what I'm used to in Tucson or in Phoenix, it's miles different than what you're going to find out in Houston or out in the South or in the Midwest, where you got tree line fairways where, I mean, you can't play the ball in the air. You can't just miss it in the air and be able to find it and have a swing at it. So that's what makes Tour Pro so good, is that they are able to play any type of golf course under any kind of circumstances, and they can still shoot sub 70 rounds with consistently.
Their game travels well, Mike, is what because they've been, and I would have to say that the kids in college golf get that kind of exposure, and that gives them a leg up on the guys like us that tried to come out of the mini tours. You know, I think that course conditions vary across the country. There's no question. And I think equipment needs to be adjusted to course equipments. And, you know, you can't play, and personally, I'm fairly steep with my wedges. I was in Northern California for 8 years. And turf conditions up there were entirely different. I had to completely rethink my wedge and my wedge setups and my grinds and my bounce. And I come down to Vegas, and it's a totally different thing. So I have basically two sets of wedges. And when I'm playing desert, hard conditions, and I use it one set. And when I'm in soft and wet and heavy grass conditions, I play a different set. So, you know, there's so many aspects to this game. It's you against the golf course, and, you know, the key is to stay in your own place and stay in your own mind and play one shot at a time, and that's very hard to do, and particularly under pressure. You know, when you get tell me about your sponsorship and how all that went. I mean, that's a whole nother ballgame when you're playing with other investors' money.
Yeah, that's one thing that I guess I can call it a blessing and a curse, that one mistake I made is that I was fully self-funded for the beginning of my career. That's one, you know, the downside of that I didn't have to worry about spending other people's money. The downside of it being that I didn't have the luxury of playing as often as I probably should have in order to kind of have, I mean, well, there's, and later on we can get into a lot of the mistakes, and that's really what the reason I wrote this book, is that I made a lot of mistakes when I started, and even through my injury, and we can talk more about exactly what happened. But as far as sponsorship money, I mean, I saw a lot. One instance that I can hopefully talk about, and I won't. I'll try to be as vague as possible with the specifics. But they had the U.S. Pro Golf Tour that came out. I think right around the time, probably around 2007, is when it really started to get big. Donald Trump, I believe, had put his footprint in it, and they were offering tournaments with $5 million purses, which, you know, in a lot of ways rivaled the PGA Tour at the time. And all of us, and I knew someone that was getting ready to play in this, and he had friends from back home and people that were able to, who were willing to invest the money for him to start. And next thing you know, the person who was operating that tour embezzled the money and disappeared.
Yes, and that was a common thread back in those days.
Yeah, and it devastated, you know, a lot of people, and I know, you know, personally know of people that were. All right, so it's very difficult to play tournament golf when you know that someone else is cutting the check. It frees you up in a way, but there's also that extra pressure, which is why, you know, one thing that I certainly advocate for anyone that is looking to play and doesn't have that money or has, you know, zero experience playing tournaments is to start as small as possible. When you get out to Phoenix or Northern and Southern California, you know, the Pepsi Tour has tournaments where you can play one day events for $200, $225. And you may not win a lot, but you get that experience, you get those, and trust me, and I've played in, you know, decent amount of those tournaments, you know, 1 and 2 day events, and the nerves are there because you know that the instant that club hits the ball on the first tee, there's no redos, there's no mulligans, there's nothing. And you have to, and it's a very easy way to gain that tournament experience. Not only that, but a lot of the tours, pretty much every tour I can think of, maintains online databases, and that can serve you well in attracting future sponsors. Because it's a lot easier to gain attention when you can actually show that you can produce the scores under tournament conditions. Yeah. It's a lot more difficult to be at your home club where you can shoot 63 every other round, but haven't tested your game out elsewhere.
Yeah, I had a good friend in Northern California, Isaac Sanchez. You may know Sasquatch. He actually made it on the Big Break.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, and Isaac was just dominant, I mean, distance-wise, and had such great touch around the greens. And first time I met him, I was running a skins game, and he showed up, and it was cold and wet, and we were playing Lincoln Hills outside of Roseville in Sacramento. And it's a Sun City course, but it was real tricky, you know, a lot of dog legs and small greens. And first hole was 340 yards, and the Squatch got there kind of late, and I always play in the last group because I have to handle all the money, and so he joined us, and I wasn't paying attention, and he teed off, and he came up and he shook my hand, and it was like shaking a bear's hand. It was like three times the size of my hand, and I didn't pay any attention, so I hit mine down the fairway and had about a 50-yard shot in. It was downhill, blind shot to a green. Sasquatch hit it over the green 25 yards and was chipping back.
Wow.
And he shot 65, the lowest score. And we had some good players in this game. The lowest other score was 76 that day. And he was 11 shots better. And he got the attention of some of the members at the club I was running, and they sponsored him, and he went out and, you know, thank, you know, his lucky stars that he got a shot at the Big Break, and from there he got a chance to play with Rand on the second time in. He got a chance to play with Jerry Rice, and they became great fans. And it's given him an opportunity to make a living in golf outside of tournament golf. And he still attempts it, but he's realized that, you know, his sponsors, my team, put him out there, and he was trying to make cuts on the Nike Tour back then, and then, of course, it rolled in the web.com tournament. It was Monday qualifying, and that was the way, honestly, that we kind of suggested he go about it. I mean, stop playing the Pepsi Tour where you can win $1,500 and go out and try to get on and get a name out on the – if you can make a cut and if you can make a Monday qualifier and make a cut. So that's how tough it is. I mean, Isaac could really play, and he had to touch around the greens. He was a good putter. And the reality is there's just a lot of people like that out there. And he got his big break on the Big Break, and he's gone on to have a nice career, and he's such a gentleman. So, Mike, tell me what happened out there. I mean, you got in a position to play, and tell us your story a little bit.
Okay. Well, I had, like I said, I played the qualifier in 2006, and it didn't go well. But I one of the biggest things I did is that I didn't put myself out there enough. And I know that, speaking to you, how big you are into nutrition, one of the big problems I had was that after that tournament and after I kind of started getting more comfortable in the world of golf, at least from the business side of it, one mistake that I made is there was at one point when I was doing all the outside stuff, I was teaching, I was running a skins game of my own, and there was a point where that skins game, it was a 9-hole skins game with a Stableford pot, that was the only golf I was playing for 5, 6 weeks in a row, just because you get into when you're making $30 an hour teaching these clinics and you're getting into the busy season in golf, and so as my stature in golf kind of grew, it kind of grew along with my waistline, and didn't really become a huge issue until about the summer of 07, where I started realizing that in order to make, now I grew up, my mentor had me, was a big follower of John Redmond, who was a big part of Paul Azinger's career, kind of taking
Yes.
his game.
I
And
know John well. He was out here in Vegas at Shadow Creek for a while as Steve Wynn's instructor. Yep.
Yeah,
Met.
and so he is a very big advocate for
Yep.
just kind of turning in a barrel and letting the club swing. The big
Hips
problem,
control the golf swing. Hips
yeah,
control the golf swing.
exactly.
Yep.
And the problem was is that my stomach was getting in the way. So
I can relate at a certain point in my career too.
so in order to compensate for that, rather than being smart about it and really taking better care of myself, I started to develop a more lateral transition where the club almost fell straight down and then came through on the side. In order to do that, I had to really start driving my knees forward. Fast forward
Like
to,
Tim Furyk. I mean, Furyk has
yeah,
that same.
exactly. So one of the biggest ironies of my career is at the time I had played in a PAT just because it was at my home course, and I was able to. It was just another way to get tournament experience for, it was $150. You play 36 holes and you got to post a number in order to pass. Shortly after that, I played in another Arizona Open qualifier and did slightly better than the time before, but I wasn't playing enough. And then so finally started to start playing PESI Tour events. At the time, I was actually working. My moonlight at the time was at for a moving was at a moving company, and this involved. I remember the last day I worked there. A friend, a coworker of mine, ended up throwing out his back when we were trying to unload and move a 600-pound desk. And so I
Oh,
figured,
that's
well, I'm gonna get myself hurt doing this. Like I said, one of the biggest ironies of my career is 2 months later, I was playing in a one-day event at Starfire Golf Club in Scottsdale, Arizona. It was, I think, December 16th, 2007. We ended up. I was living in Tucson. We drove up that morning. Happened to be one of those days where the morning low was 28 degrees. Which, as you working, in Vegas all the time, when it's 28 degrees, you're gonna have a delay.
Yep.
Ended up having a 3.5 hour delay. The range was closed. Wasn't smart enough to think about stretching, and so you couple being over 308 pounds, no warm up. Finally started teed off at around 3.5, about 2.5 hours later, and on the third hole, at the time, in order to my big miss was the right, and in order to avoid that, I had this thing kind of like what Tiger did was, and I'm left-handed by the way, in order to avoid missing with a hook, I would really, really focus on snapping my leg, my knee. This particular time, I snapped it and it went out of place,
Nice.
pretty much all the way to the side of my leg, and I proceeded to fall backwards and scream to the heavens.
I can imagine that would be
And
painful.
I and so I'm laying there screaming. Everyone thinks I'm laughing, which is kind of, which was really like the last, was the last reaction I was expecting to see. So thankfully, there was, it happened on the third hole, which was right next to a residential road, which is right next to an entrance to the residential community. And so it was real easy for the paramedics. So that part was bad. The real bad part was when I went to the emergency room, when they tried to pop my knee back into place, it got stuck. And I didn't find out it was stuck until the next day when I was back in Tucson and had surgery 3 days later, ended up losing about, I think, one decent chunk of cartilage and then another small sliver of cartilage. And so I was, it was kind of a blessing and a curse at the time because I asked my surgeon, like, will I be able to play golf again? He's like, well, if you lose the weight, then you should have no problem being able to play again. And so I went, since I had plenty of time on my hands to sit around and wait for my knee to heal before physical therapy, I started reading up on books, and I think I ended up losing about 60 pounds within the 3.5 months that I had, probably like 45 pounds during physical therapy and 65 when I teed it up again in June. I ended up playing a 2-day event where I didn't really have much, like I had an awful first 27 holes. And then I talk about it in the book where I finally just decided to try to get the ball on the hole, not worry about getting the swing mechanics right, just kind of bunt it out there. And I ended up shooting even on the back nine on the second day with 3 birdies. And although I played the par fives 3 over, but you know, I was able to at least get a score out of it and show that, hey, if I still have a chance, even when things are going completely wrong, to score. And then the next tournament, everything fell apart. The first hole at have you played Stallion Mountain?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so you know the first hole.
I actually opened it. It was that's a combination of the 3 golf courses, mm-hmm. actually.
So the first hole there is a, you know, straightaway par 4, 420 yards, and first tee shot, duck hooked out of bounds. The second tee shot.
That would be, to the right for you.
To the right,
left.
Correct.
Into the houses, yeah. So that was number hooked. One on the west course for a long time.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I use a Stallion Mountain hole because it's basically this hole at Talking Stick is where I played my last event. So snapped hooked out of bounds. There was also houses at Talking Stick to the left, but I mean, we're talking 40 yards left of the fairway. And that's where my next 2 tee shots went to compensate for the hook. And then finally got my 4th tee shot in bounds, my 8th shot on the green, and then 3-putted for an 11. I happened to be playing that day with a wonderful gentleman. He was a utility player for the Oakland Athletics back in the 80s, or played most of his career with Oakland, ended up, he actually won a World Series with Detroit in 87, I believe. His name's Tony Phillips. And I'm pretty sure he beat me by about 30 shots that day. Just everything that you could imagine going wrong went wrong. When I finally got a tee shot and play in the fairway on a par 5, had a 2-iron into the green, ended up snap hooking that up against a tree, up against the trunk of a tree. When I went to address the ball for my 3rd shot, the ball moved down. So I had to replace it, pop it out, chip it on, and 2-putt for a 6. Had a plugged lie that was so bad on a par 3 that I half topped it trying to get it out on the 2nd shot. It really demoralized kind of everything. And fast forward another year later, I started having back trouble from the immobility in my knees, and it was right around that time. So 2009 is pretty much when I hung up playing any kind of competitive golf for a while.
I know. I had back issues too about the time I turned 45, and fortunately at that point I literally was just teaching full time, and so I was able to take 3 years off, and I went through the same process. I lost 40 pounds, went through physical therapy, hundreds of chiropractors, and I finally got my back in a position where it naturally fused the lower two vertebrae without surgery, and I'm able to play again today. But it was a long process, Mike, and I there's a lot of ways you can injure yourself in golf. And I think at the level of athletic ability and the way these kids are working out and grinding and grinding in the gyms, and I just don't know how long their bodies are going to be able to take that kind of torque and that kind of pressure. I mean, you know, I think one of Tiger's deal was he did the Navy SEALs routine all the time, and I think that it's gotten to a point now where you'll see the careers of these golfers not last as long as just due to physical problems. And people don't understand what it takes to consistently hit a golf ball solid. It's the margin of error is very, very small, and it requires dedication. I remember when I hurt my back, I was literally bending down to tee a ball up for a woman in my class, and I had a massive back spasm, and it was like somebody stuck a hot knife in my back. And if any of you guys and gals out there can relate, it's happened to all of us. It's happened to the tour players. So let's get back to the book for a second. Your tournament, there's a section on tournament golf philosophy, which I found interesting in it. I think we've kind of covered a lot of that. There's also a section in here on a sample practice schedule for someone that has tour aspirations, which I thought was good. Anything else you'd like to talk about right now in the book? There's a section on equipment, how to get equipment. Of course, I'm a master club fitter, so I would always send my students to a trained Henry Griffiths preferably fitter. We have more knowledge about golf and equipment and pioneered it all for the industry. But I think if you're going to aspire to play golf, you need to have equipment that fits you. I guarantee you the tour pros out there are not playing stock equipment, and it's constantly being tinkered with, constantly being adjusted, constantly being monitored with launch monitors. They're always trying to maximize the performance of their clubs and their swing. And it's different from when we were growing up. We had a set of eyeballs and we hit shots we felt the club. Is it working? But that's all changed. And that's kind of thanks to Randy Henry and developing the Henry Griffiths club fitting model, and which has now been absorbed and is part of the PGA manual now. So I think that equipment is a big deal if you're out there trying to get on, play better. And a lot of people think, well, I'm not good enough for equipment, but that's a misnomer too, because your feedback is fundamental. And without good equipment, how can you get good feedback?
Exactly. I mean, if there's anything that, and I agree with you that it's important to get to have equipment. The basis of that chapter was to illustrate first, if you're not sure where the best place is to find equipment, there are other options rather than spending $800 to $1,200 just on a set of irons or something like that. But what the biggest part of that chapter was to talk about the things that you actually need versus the things that you don't, and how to get you're going to need, if you're really going to be serious about understanding your game and understanding the feedback you get, you must have some decent quality premium golf balls in a shag bag to use around the greens. And if you can, even for like 125 yards and in, using range balls it's okay for warm-ups, but you really want to get that feedback from how your grooves react to the ball that you use for tournament play. Another thing is once you start making it, one thing that I had that I struggled with when I first started, and I was actually a Cleveland guy when I started it, there was no information about that. It was, make a phone call to manufacturers and find out what the policies were. So I was able to kind of highlight, the kind of the things that I did, but also to dissuade people from thinking that you need a lot of a lot of different gadgets and things to improve your game. Really, if you have a chalk line and a couple of the reflector rods for alignment, I mean, everything else is really it might have supplement, it might have incremental improvement, or it might help a little bit with improving your game, but it's really more about things that you can't take with you on the golf course. And so you want to keep it as I'm a big advocate of keeping things as simple and as minimalistic as possible, and try to create the conditions that you're going to be in as much as possible.
Yeah, I agree. And there are some things that have value. I think video is overvalued. I think it has a purpose, particularly for less than, you know, your scratch golfer. I mean, I think it benefits them a little bit more in some ways, but I know when video first came out, man, we jumped on board as teachers back in the late 80s, and we had the beta cams and the first VCRs, and I discovered after a year or so that my students were getting better on video, and then, of course, MIT did a study in the mid-90s and proved that theory, so we began to realize that, you know, ball flight laws and motion – setup is so fundamental, Mike, and I think people overlook the fact that great golfers don't lose their golf swings overnight. They get caught in a setup situation. Maybe the shoulders get a little open, the ball gets a little out of position, and they're good enough to compensate for it for a while, and then it creates other compensations. And so you know that's why you 90 most of the time, anytime a professional is out practicing, he's going to have a caddy standing behind him, he's going to have alignment rods on the ground, he's going to be very specific about what he's doing, and he's, you know, knowing that, you know you can if you're playing equipment that fits you how often do the manufacturers run up to him and offer him the new latest greatest putter or wedge or driver? And you know, back when I was doing it, that was common. I mean, now all these guys have contracts, so they're only dealing with one company for the most part. But, you know, in the day, I remember going to the driving range at some of these tournaments that we were in, and there'd be some manufacturers out there trying to, you know, particularly the newer ones and the smaller ones out there trying to get you to try their stuff. And, you know, I would take a golf club and I would swing it one time. And if I felt like I hit my finish and nailed and it was in balance and the ball wasn't going where I was looking, I would hand it back to him, because I know in three swings I could probably get it going to the target, but I don't want it to affect my game. I don't want to have to compensate to get the face pointing at the target. I want it to just flow right into the ball. And so I've seen that happen. I've seen, and you've heard the stories of the guys that finally get out there and they start making money and they might win a tournament, and all of a sudden they change equipment and they disappear again for a while. So it's an interesting game, and I do believe in keeping it simple. I think setup is fundamental. I think you've got to be careful if you're a range Roger Ranger or a range rat. I don't think that just beating golf balls is that productive, and I enjoyed that
good.
Part of your book.
I mean, yeah, it looks good, and you have people, and you have people that can't do it that are awe inspired. But anyone that's gonna see that and they offer to play you know $20 a hole or a $20 Nassau, then they probably are saying that knowing that you might be able to hit it well on the range, but you have to. It is absolutely imperative that for every hour or so that you put in on the range, 2 hours have to be spent on the golf course, whether it's trying to shape different tee shots, trying different flights, different approaches into greens, even just dropping a few balls and hitting different chip shots with different lofts with the wedge. I mean, there's so many other different elements to the game that, you know, range time is really maybe 5% of it, where you have to have a repeatable motion. But once you get past that, it's really just a matter of being able to adjust to any circumstance that you can find and be able to execute properly. And that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one common fundamental of all great players is good balance and good footwork. And, you know, I don't think it's that complicated. A good friend of mine Dalton straight shooting McCreary, always used to tell me, it ain't rocket science. And he had simple, my mentors kept things so simple for me when I was growing up. Newton used to just say, you know, you rotate to load and you transfer your weight to the finish. And Jimmy Ballard used to say, he goes, big guy, just keep your elbows down and your arms in front, you know. And if you looked at any of the great, I mean, I looked at, you know, there's some great instructional books out there. Hogan's book is great. There's been other books. But if you look at any of them and they're worth anything at all, and let's say it's a 100-page book, I would say at least 60% of that book should be about setup, grip, and fundamentals. I mean, and if you look at them truthfully, that's how pretty much what it is. I know some of the instructional books I've read are all about setup. I think that if you're aspiring to play golf out there, I think Mike Hebron's got some books that are tremendous for the mental part. You know, his book Play to Learn and Learn to Play is a fantastic book about getting you off the practice area and onto the golf course playing golf. You know, it's a target game. It's not a hit the ball game. And I just, it frustrates me to no end to work with, to see these kids out there just grinding and grinding, hitting balls, hitting balls, hitting balls. And it's like, I mean, take a breath. Yeah. I mean, you just, hit 100 balls in 20 minutes. Slow down, hit shots, pick targets, you know, get creative. I mean, I just, and I agree that you need to have, if you're going to practice your short game in particular, you need to have your golf ball in your practice bag, and you have to find facilities that, give you that opportunity to practice those things. And it's not always the case, at your home course.
And then just to kind of touch on that part, then in the digging it out chapter, I talk about kind of the one thing. 95% of the book has nothing to do with technique, but the one thing I do talk about in regard to the golf swing is that it has to be, it's akin to creating a sculpture. And the key to that being is that I've never seen a sculpture that's taken from a clean slate of plaster that has more material on it than it did when it started. So building a golf swing is not about, anytime that you want to improve it, it's not a matter of adding something to it. It's a matter of taking things away. And whether it be swing thoughts, whether it be motions that don't lead to something that's repeatable, and it should become something that when you're out on the golf course and you're out there playing seriously, that it's not something you think of. Probably the best anecdote is I was playing with a beverage cart girl at a course in Tucson, and after I hit a tee shot, she asked me, how much wrist do you use? And I probably gave her probably a 10-second blank stare because I didn't know how to answer it. Because it's not a matter of what you do to make something happen, it's just a matter of making it happen. And any player that can just stand out there, see the shot and feel it, and execute are the ones that are going to have the best chances of success out on tour.
Yes, and I agree. And it's interesting because there are some guys out on tour that do fairly well that are very, very mechanically oriented, and it's just it's amazing to me. It's just that's the way they're wired, and so you know, there's always exceptions to every rule, but you know, it's the guys like Jordan Spieth and Ben Crenshaw and Phil Mickelson who just fires the ball out there and goes finds it and hits the next shot and tries to get the ball in the hole. I mean, it's and you know, Phil's won a lot of tournaments and you know, over 50 tournaments on the tour, and you know, it's I really look forward to Silverado this year, the start of the new season, and you know, Phil's been lobbying for he and Tiger to play together. I think that would, for us old guys, for us guys that watch, I mean, I used to do rules contests for the AJGA event here in Vegas out at the Legacy, and Tiger used to come up when he was a teenager, and I watched him play then, and I was just blown away by even then the sound of his ball coming off the face. And, you know, we're kind of winding down here, Mike, and I want to give you an opportunity to let people know how they can get a hold of your book and just kind of give us some closing thoughts.
Okay. Well, you can, all of my books, I actually have a total of four. One, the Professional Golf for the Rest of Us is like the main book. It's the one that's longer than five pages. I have three short little brochures that kind of give an idea. Nothing I write is very mechanical or technical. It's more so about just different ways to think things, ways to imagine, to be creative with your practice, or be creative with how to, you know, getting out of ruts, ways to make practice more enjoyable, and things like that. You can find all my books at my author page on Amazon, which is amazon.com/author/Mike Guillen. You can also
spell your name, Mike, for those, because it's a tough name.
Yeah, it's a tough last name. It's, unless you're a baseball fan, it's usually pretty tough.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a Mike, and then my last name is spelled G-U-I-L-L-E-N. You can also find me in social media in terms of preference. You can find me on Facebook, which is facebook.com/Mike Guillen Golf, or you can just search for me in the search for my name. There aren't very many of us, especially in Las Vegas. Instagram, also you can find me. That's probably one of my favorite to use, instagram.com/Mike Guillen Golf. And if you're in Vegas, you want to find and you want to be able to pick it up, you can also find it at Vegas Golf Incorporated over there at Sahara and Decatur. Thanks again, Bill, for the opportunity. Because you didn't find the book there, then we wouldn't be having this interview. And it's been a great pleasure to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed you coming on the show, Mike, and I always like to support our local guys. By the way, you know, I've got this incredible learning center over at the Las Vegas Country Club, two indoor simulators. I've got the whole outdoor facility. Why don't you stop by sometime? Make sure, I'd love to meet you in person, and I'd love to maybe play some golf with you.
That sounds fantastic. We'll definitely get something like that worked out.
Yeah. You got me now, so give me a call. Come on out sometime. I don't know what your schedule's like, but I'll be there. I probably won't be there tomorrow. We're still closed. The range just opened, so I've got lessons on Thursday and Friday and Saturday. But give me a call. Let's make sure we get out and play some golf. And once the club opens, I'll get you out there and we'll go play.
When does the club open up again?
We're going to open on the 15th of October. We close for an entire month and do a complete overseed. We've got a wonderful super that used to be at Oakmont, and then he was at Shadow Creek and at the Wind for a while. Now we've got him, and he's doing a wonderful job. Some of the best par fours in town, Parkland-style golf course. Mike, it's not one of these desert golf courses we get so used to out here. It's just old school. It's like playing in a park. I love it. So, Mike, thanks for joining me on the show today. Let's get together, and maybe we'll do something else down the road. Obviously, if you get another book written, we'd definitely put that on, and let's talk golf. I want to say
anytime.
Thank you for coming, and we'll talk soon.
All right, sounds good.
Well, folks, it's time to say goodbye to this episode of Fairways and Greens. Hope you enjoyed the show. And if you would like to subscribe to the show, just head over to golfcoachpodcast.com. That's www.golfcoachpodcast.com. And don't forget to reach out with your questions and your input on the show to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. So reach out with your questions and anything you'd like to add or any suggestion on future shows to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. You can find me, the Vegas Golf Coach, and a link to my blogs, coaching centers, and programs at www.vegasgolfcoach.com. That's www.vegasgolfcoach.com. So goodbye for now, and here's to finding your share of fairways and greens in your journey through life and golf.
This podcast was a presentation of LightUpMedia.fm.